Welcome to Eucharist Podcast, where we're exploring what it looks like for a community of disciples to live all of life in reference to Christ. Well, welcome back to the Eucharist Podcast. I'm Father Joshua.
I'm Father Ryan.
And happy Advent or Merry Christmas, depending on when you're listening to this.
Yeah, we're right at the end of Advent. It's been quite a busy season for us.
I know, we've lit the last candle and now we're kind of like in between the two spaces,
that right? Liminal space, longing for Christmas.
Yeah. I know.
And we've been so busy with so much in the life of the church too, and just the end of the year has, the end of the calendar year has so much that throws at us, so.
Yeah. I don't know if I'm so much longing for Christmas as just like the new year.
Well, you're also taking a week off after Christmas, so you know, you're longing for that too, right?
I am longing for that. And I mean, we are technically in the new year, right?
That's true.
So, yeah. But I'm excited every year. I've really liked trying to practice like the full 12 days of Christmas, like being very intentional about like, it's not just about like Christmas morning, but like trying to find ways to like have sustained joy for those 12 days, which I still don't know what that's going to look like for my family, but I think it's going to involve like hiking and visiting friends and travel. So
one practical thing that our church can learn to do together is fasting and feasting we talk about.
Oh yeah.
And one of the things that we don't do well is we don't know how to fast. And Advent is actually a kind of fasting season. It's not the same as, not quite to the depth of Lent perhaps, but it is a fasting season. And if you fast, then the release from that is a season of joy, a season of feasting. So even if you're still going to work and you're doing things, but you can live into at least a 12-day season where you're not fasting. And that probably only means something to you if you usually fast on Wednesdays and Fridays or whatever the church has done, you know, traditionally. So anyway, I'm looking forward to feasting during the time of Christmas.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, let's get into the reading that we had today. I think we're going to be covering the last three chapters of the book, The Patient Ferment, chapter 8, 9, and 10.
Yep. They're really three chapters that give us, in a sense, three snapshots of the church historically. One is the first chapter is about a document called the Didascalia or Didascalia. We don't even know how to say it. Anyway, it's a document that was written in the 230s approximately. So, and it was written to the Syrian churches, which means it was more of an Eastern focused part of Christianity. And then the second chapter is that we're talking about is about Constantine. And that is a hot topic historically about what was happening with Constantine. And then the third chapter is post-Constantine Augustine, St. Augustine, who is in the West a giant figure that shapes everything that comes after him. Mm-hmm. So our author, Alan Kreider, is in a sense giving us these three snapshots as a final piece of the book. And we're going to talk about all of them today.
I think just as a kind of reminder, that's kind of, for me, it's kind of helps anchor this is like, so this is a Syrian document, and this is kind of the same people group that are around today that are going through such a difficult and just horrendous time. And
it puts it in historical context. These are not abstract ideas. These are real people. And some of those churches and communities that have been consistently worshiping as Christians for 2,000 years have been destroyed and disrupted. It's really quite sad, actually.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes, you know, when we read old documents, like it can be almost kind of like Narnia or something, like disconnected. And you're like, oh, wait a minute. Like, these are the people that our church have actually taken up a collection to help this year. And this is like part of that heritage. And it's just, it's nice for me, like reading that. I was like, oh, wow. Like, man, this is real.
It's real stuff. Yeah. Yeah. So let me give you a quick overview. We're not going to talk much about the chapter called The Wise Doves in the Didascalia Apostolorum. That's such a bunch of Latin there. But basically, as I said, it's a compiled document that was written by several different authors. We don't know who they are. And it's really instructions to these churches in Syria. And it's the most detailed look at kind of everyday life in the church before the period of Constantine, where Christianity had the support of the empire or the state. And in this chapter, the major emphasis that he makes is how what was distinctive about the life of the early church was, of course, this patience that he talks about, exemplified in their value of peace, of an active kind of unity and peace-seeking that shaped the life of the community. And that that was a focus, that was focused particularly on reconciliation as a major value within the mm-hmm. church.
You know, as I was reading this chapter, and as we're talking about this aspect of like how much of a core value peacemaking was to the early church, mm-hmm. I can't help but think about like our political environment right now, how polarization and mm-hmm. antagonism and discord seems to be more of the norm. And there's, I think often Christians like to take one side or the other and basically add to the noise instead of really taking seriously our vocation as peacemakers to really mm-hmm. listen and to be the people that bring people together, because there's not that many people doing it.
Well, I think what's particularly difficult is not the discord in society, it's the discord within the church that reflects the society's discord.
Yeah.
And it's because there isn't really a clear sense of a clear unity, a clear consensus about how Christians ought to be involved even in a society that is not Christian. You know, that's part of the challenge we live in.
I think part of it is how we're mimicking our environment mm. and we're being shaped by the liturgy or the habitus of our world, which is increasingly polarized. Mm-hmm. Yes. You know, we're bringing that into the church.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, we're not going to say much about this first chapter because there's a lot to say about the other two, but it is a fascinating window into the early church and just the nuts and bolts of how they thought about what they were doing. So the next chapter, which is chapter 9, is entitled The Impatience of Constantine. And you might gather from that chapter title that Dr. Alan Kreider has a criticism of Constantine. And let me give a little bit of context for some of our listeners who may not be completely familiar with what happened here. So Christianity was like a pretty small marginalized group. Not very many people for most of its time before Constantine. And then about the time of Constantine, it was peaking perhaps on the optimistic side at maybe 10% of the empire were Christians, which is about 6 million. So maybe think 5 to 6 million Christians now across the empire. And right before Constantine, an emperor named Diocletian enacted a really severe persecution of Christians. So people died, people were, you know, fed to the wild beasts in the arena and crucified and things like that. Terrible things were done. So when Constantine came on the scene, and Constantine was not a Christian, he did not grow up as a Christian, but when he had his famous vision in which he encountered something of the Christian God and some, it's just kind of mysterious what happened there. There was a, you know, he looked and he saw the symbol of the cross, but he was also looking at the sun, and it was like unclear whether this was sort of a pagan slash Christian experience, but he was told to fight in the name of, or in the under this symbol. By this conqueror, yeah, exactly. That was the idea. And then he went out and he destroyed his enemies, and he became eventually the only emperor. He defeated the Eastern emperor and became full emperor of the empire. And so as he did that, then he legalized Christianity. He reversed the policies of Diocletian. Persecution ended. And for the first time, Christians had the most powerful person in the land as a kind of advocate for them.
They had kind of like the moral majority almost.
Let's not go there.
We won't.
Yeah. And here was a man who was flirting with being identified as a Christian, and he becomes generous. He starts to enact more Christian legislation. He puts bishops as judges to help bring justice to the lower classes. He frees slaves in the context of the church. He outlaws crucifixion. He outlaws branding people on the face, which was something that was apparently done in the ancient world. He outlaws the arena games as being not part of the empire anymore. So he does some things that are like, wow, these are really positive steps, right?
So really he was, in a lot of ways, living a lot of the fullness of the Christian life, except for at least one thing.
Yeah, he wasn't baptized. And actually, specifically, he broke off catechesis. So he initially had this vision, and then he invited sort of theologians and bishops and priests to talk to him about it. And then he basically broke it off, and he's like, no, it's okay. I'll go ahead and do this on my own terms.
Yeah. I was struck by that because, to be honest, I never had that high of a view of Constantine. I thought he was just using Christianity as a political tool.
Right. opportunistically,
yeah. But here it did seem like, man, he was actually doing a lot of things that, like, social justice stuff that were like, yeah, like, that's yeah. awesome. Yeah. But then some of the deeper things, like submitting to baptism, and not just baptism itself, but that process of acquiring a Christian habitus.
Yes.
And actually
yes.
really bowing the knee to Christ as king was something he was kind of holding off on, it seems. So he loved Christ as a social justice cause or advocate.
In some ways, right?
In some ways.
Yeah.
But, you know, it only
goes... He loved it so as a deep. Unifying force for the empire, too, to have, you know, paganism was crumbling at that time. And so this is the more opportunistic story, which he was like, oh, this is a way to unify the empire, which is somewhat true, but if less than 10% of the empire was Christian, that's not that substantial.
So he was good at using Christianity as a unifying force for social good.
Yes, potentially.
But he wasn't... it didn't seem to go deeper than that until later on, if at all.
Now, if you know anything about Constantine, you know that he is like the subject of massive controversy in historical scholarship. Not too long ago, a couple years ago, a guy named Peter Lighthart, who's a very interesting thinker, wrote a book defending Constantine from a narrative which is really saying that he was just an opportunist and he wasn't really a Christian, he didn't care. So he kind of emphasizes he's trying to redeem Constantine. And he's trying to redeem Constantine from another scholar who's a more Anabaptist, which is what Alan Kreider, that's his tradition, a guy named John Howard Yoder, who was all about a peaceful form of Christianity that was not involved in the state and in the empire at all. And so there's two conflicting narratives that are sort of fighting with each other about the history. And obviously, Alan Kreider, because he's in the Anabaptist tradition, seems to lean towards John Howard Yoder. Mm-hmm. But he's balanced. He's not a kind of like, he wants to tell a real story about what's going on.
I'll say, like, reading this chapter actually gave me a better impression of Constantine than I had going into it.
Interesting.
Like, I never knew, he talks on page 251 about Constantine was fascinated by Christian theology and became an expert in it. He had lots of Christian friends, including clergy. And he subsidized churches and buildings. He had like this special chapel built. Was it in his imperial palace or something like that? Or something for his personal use. Like, he gave a lot to the church. And it made me realize, like, wow, like, I'd love to have Constantine as part of like most churches. Like, he was like a mover and shaker. He could lead a Bible study. He could, you know, spearhead a giving campaign. Like, he was the dude. And then you're like, oh, wait a minute, but
it's a mixed bag,
yeah.
Right? Because then you get like a mixed notion of what it means to be a Christian. Because this is the challenge with him. He's fundamentally redefining the norms of Christianity, and that's like. I mean, that's why people look at this point in the story of Christianity as a really big hinge point.
Well, yeah. I mean, I kind of say it in jest, but a lot of the things that we culturally emphasize in the church as being important, like theology and giving and even acts of social justice, like Constantine had it. Mm. Like, a lot of the values that we now have are reflected. And so maybe Constantine isn't that much different than many of us modern Americans in our interaction with Christianity, as like we have this kind of conversion experience or the spiritual experience, and then we decide to pick and choose from Christianity.
Yeah.
Like,
What do we like?
It's kind of a. How can we incorporate it into our life instead of incorporating our life style. Into the church, you know?
Yeah. And so what Dr. Alan Kreider is emphasizing is that because he never formally entered into catechesis and learned from the tradition, was submitted himself to the church, then he never really fully took on the habitus that we've been talking about of Christianity. And instead, his habitus continued to be shaped more by aristocracy, by the notions of what the imperial court had done, and by the military service, which those are all three major influences in his life. So he didn't get the embodied reactions or the embodied habitus again of what Christianity really is all about.
And he kind of diluted the water in the way, because he seemed to be one of the first Christians that had the power.
Yes.
or first people to have an affinity for Christ that had the power to kind of do things, like to innovate, to do something differently, because I'm the king or I'm the emperor, you know?
And he did, you know, part of his legacy is that he helped call together the Council of Constantinople, where the Council of Nicaea, where the first council, where we had the it's called the ecumenical, because all the different bishops, from as much as possible from the empire, from the whole region, came together in order to resolve a theological dispute that had arisen about the nature of Christ.
Some of them limping in, having lost limbs in the previous persecution.
Right, yeah.
Like, this is
such vivid imagery.
I mean, 1 week you're worshiping in the catacombs, having been maimed for the faith, and then the next week you're literally given the keys to a cathedral, a pagan cathedral, saying, hey, do whatever you want.
So on Constantine's dollar, he brings all these people, ships them in from all across the world, in a sense. And then he wines and dines them. And so obviously he wins a lot of influence. He actually presides over the council, and that he calls it. Now, he gets to sort of formally articulate some of the final words about it, but it's really the conversation is between the bishops. But it becomes confusing, because initially Constantine is happy to support what is orthodox in terms of Athanasius, who is there, is articulating an orthodox position against Arius. And then later on, though, Constantine gets under the influence of some confusing bishops, and he flip-flops, because, and he exiles people. Well,
that's the thing that kind of connected some dots, because to be honest, he kind of just seemed like a theology fan, like a fan
He's
of
a
theology.
Junkie. Yeah.
But without much skin in the game. So he liked theology as ideas, but I don't know. It was interesting. I think also the thing that helps me understand, I mean, Constantine's a mixed bag, and I think we have to believe that God was still sovereign during this process, and the Holy Spirit was still leading the church. It wasn't that Constantine came and did something the Holy Spirit couldn't do or thwarted what the Holy Spirit wanted to do.
Right.
But it is interesting, though, that there was this crack in the tradition that seems to happen here, where Constantine creates a new class or a new way to be Christian that was kind of an extended liminal space where you're kind of not fully in but not fully out. You're identifying as Christian, but you're not really fully. It's kind of like the whole controversy, like growing up, people are like, well, Jesus is your savior, but is he your Lord? Mm. And how that created this kind of two-tier level of nominal Christians
so
versus
unhelpful.
The faithful, which is horrible, but it seems that this was the first precedence for that.
This is where Alan Kreider, the author, says, he describes him as like a liminal Christian. Like he lives, in his language, on the threshold of the church, on the doorstep, you could think. And if you go back to our earlier podcast where we talk about the picture of sort of the household of God being a house and an extended front porch being a space for seeking and then catechesis, that's where he kind of hangs out on the front porch. But he normalizes that as being what it means to be a Christian. And that's confusing. In fact, after this, there's a lot of people who, like Constantine, delayed their baptism until their deathbed. That became a much more popular thing to do because, well, look at this. The most powerful man in the land claims to be Christian, but he's not baptized, which, by the way, means he's not communing. He's not taking communion because he's not baptized. So it renormalizes Christianity on the front porch rather than in the household
of
God.
And it makes it culturally advantageous for people that are undecided to just kind of throw their lot in with the Christians, yet never truly be that.
Yeah. So maybe one of the questions we should reflect on for a moment is why didn't he want to enter fully into catechesis and get baptized? And maybe it seems like part of this is that as emperor, he still wanted to be able to use coercion and violence when he wanted to. And this is part of what Alan Kreider is saying, is that he didn't really want to fully submit to the peace tradition of the church. Now, I know there are people who argue that that had already, and other thinkers previous to this, had already sort of not been as tightly identified as true Christian identity as maybe Alan Kreider would want to say. Like maybe there's more nuance, that there were people before Constantine who had already sort of compromised on military service or things like that. But certainly there was something that he was resisting. And in fact, you see this in the year 326, there's a controversy with his wife and his son. And in classic imperial form, he executes them. He kills his own wife and his son because they end up being a threat to his throne, to his rule. Well, that's clearly not Christian behavior, right? Yeah. Like you can't do that if you're going to be a communing Christian.
It really seems that Constantine, as they say in the South, bless his heart. Constantine, bless his heart, was a man caught between two worlds.
Yeah.
Like he
wanted to have his cake and eat it too.
Yeah. And, but also, I mean, we don't have an experience of this before where an emperor was Christian and actually had to, I mean, Christianity was only a couple hundred years old. Mm-hmm. This was something new for them. Like how, because if you look at the Old Testament, like, oh, well, the king of Israel killed people and he was still a king.
Right.
And they didn't think, I don't know if they had the imagination at that time, or he didn't, or maybe he just didn't want to really parse out what it means to be a Christian emperor.
And what a complicated role.
Yeah.
Let's just be honest. Yeah. Like being the emperor of this massive pagan empire as a Christian, that's a job I would not want.
Well, I mean, just to bring it down, like, you know, police officer, or yeah. I have lots of friends that are in law enforcement or work in jails. Mm-hmm. You have to wear two hats that are in tension with each other. There's yeah. this like wanting to be loving and compassionate and gracious, but also saying, no, like, if I don't crack down and if I don't punish in sometimes a way that might not seem as gracious as the Christian ideal, it's going to cause chaos. Yeah. I'm just going to be a pushover. And so it's this really difficult
I feel space. That tension. Like, yeah, I feel that tension when I encounter people who are involved in, say, military service for our country. I know that at one level they're doing something deeply sacrificial. They're putting themselves in harm's way. They're often at the first lines of humanitarian assistance in the world. You know, they often help maintain peace. That's what their goal is. And yet they're called to go and kill, or they operate drones that, you know, kill civilians at times, or they're part of the military industrial complex, which is, can do great harm all around the world. You know, obviously America is the most dominant military force the history has ever seen. So it's super complicated. And what I would like to say is, I don't want a cheap, simplified answer, but I'd like a more rigorous conversation about how do we as Christians identify first as that, as Christians, and not sort of split ourselves down the middle. So I don't know if I have easy answers to all this, but I would like to leave the tension there and say, maybe we ought to look at the church in its earliest stages and ask questions about why people didn't do some of these jobs. Maybe we ought to do it with great humility if we do it, and maybe we ought to do it with certain limits and say, mm-hmm. we won't do certain things. It's just against, we'd rather lose our job, lose our career track, whatever, than participate in certain things. And, you know, and then even later on, it's interesting that when people were involved in military, when they were involved in somehow or another taking lives, whether directly or indirectly, the church would require them like a 3-year penance period. I don't know if you know that. Did you?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So they...
Well, I think you told me about that before. That's
how. Yeah, they actually can't... they couldn't take communion for 3 years because they recognized they had done something that was deeply contradictory to their fundamental identity. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I don't know how to resolve that. And I agree with you, the complicatedness of him being emperor and trying to figure out how to be a Christian, what he was carving up new ground.
Well, I think the interesting thing, as you're saying, I think... if I can impose something on him, it seemed like he had a split self. He categorized that he was kind of, he had the Emperor Constantine and then he had the wannabe Christian Constantine. Mm-hmm. And he maybe, who knows, only God knows, he kind of was happy with those kind of compartmentalized identities and didn't seek this difficult conversation to connect those two.
Yeah.
Which I think we have to have the same thing in the world today because we're forced to wear different hats.
Yeah,
and we need to have the habitus or the habit of allowing our different categories to cross-pollinate in step with the Spirit, and seeing how that we can bring all things into unity in Christ, even these things that in a fallen world have to coexist. I mean, there is a time for peace, there's a time for war, because we still live in a fallen world that the kingdom is in breaking, but we still have to deal with these issues.
And I think and how to do that faithfully is again complicated. So,
and not just relocating it to, like, I think the problem is we often just relocate it like, oh, war is all evil or it's all good. We kind of go to the extreme without asking the hard questions in the middle. It's easy for us to relocate it to one of those.
Yeah, yeah. One of the best summaries, I think, of what Constantine was doing during his life is by a historian named Ramsay MacMullan, who says that Constantine was decidedly a Christian on his own terms. That's his like summarization. I think that's such a telling phrase that maybe Constantine would have been most benefited in figuring out how to be a Christian emperor by submitting himself first and foremost to catechesis, to being formally adopted into the catechumenate, going through baptism, communing as a part of the life of the church, rather than just toying with the identity and deciding on his own terms, you know, apart from the tradition, how to do that. I think that's a good word for us. Mm. I think that we all live in complicated times, and maybe our first step is not to figure out in advance what it will mean, you know, whatever our job is or whatever our role is, but to first submit ourselves to catechesis and to the identity being formed in us, the habitus being formed in us by the church. And out of that mix, let the answers emerge from that. That would be my word for what I think I get from this.
I think there's some similarities with probably some of the ego or aspect of power and freedom that Constantine had as a king or as an emperor that we have as 21st century Westerners or Americans or whatever. We have a lot of freedom and a lot of the ability for self-definition and to we have almost that kingly right of, don't tell me what to do, I'm going to do
it. Well, that was the goal of the Enlightenment, right? Which is in France. Autonomy. In France, lopped the king's head off, right? We're all kings. We're all our own kings.
And so in so many ways, Constantine's difficulty and Constantine's journey is many of our journey. And I think for us, submitting to Christ's lordship in humility and to the church in a way too is really important.
So let's just wrap up that for a second. So just to tell you the end of the story. So Constantine had his first initial encounter with Christ in that vision in the year 312. In the year 337, as he's approaching his death, he actually does submit to catechesis and becomes formally a catechumen. And he is baptized shortly before he dies, which is interesting that he puts it off all the way till then. But he does die as a Christian.
And he doesn't wear purple, right?
Yeah, interestingly, he never takes the purple robe, which is the robe of royalty, and he never wears that again after his baptism. He has put away his emperor identity and adopted the identity of a baptismal candidate or someone who's been baptized, a white robe.
Yeah.
The robe of Christ's righteousness.
Which I found really, really profound.
Yeah.
I think that was probably one of the most significant, more than his even presiding over the council, the fact that he would set aside his kingly robes to having Christ as his king, which, I mean, it would be a huge thing for an emperor.
Yeah, massive. Okay, so the last chapter is the chapter on Augustine, or as I hear you say, Joshua, Augustine. And there's a debate. How do we say this? Augustine, Augustine, tomato, tomato. I'm going to say Augustine, but you can say Augustine if you want. Anyway, Augustine. Not that one.
Aaron.
Augustine is, as we said, a giant figure in Western Christianity, and he lives post-Constantine, so the shift has already begun to happen in the empire. Christian identity is in flux, and in the 4th century into the 5th century, there's a lot of theological crises going on. So there's a lot of heady talk about how do we talk about the Trinity rightly? How do we talk about the nature of Christ? And Augustine also is maybe the first person to really shift the focus of Christianity to the primary concern of Christian identity to inner motivation. He's thinking about the psychological dynamics. It's a kind of interior focus for Augustine, which gives rise to a lot of spirituality that shapes us for the, you know, in the post-Augustine world that we live in. So his concern is more for inner motivation than it is for outward habitus. And that has implications as well, that in a sense, the kind of two-tier Christianity you started to talk about, Joshua, begins to be normalized by him as well. He thinks of patience and this notion of peace, et cetera. That's good for monks and for clergy, but for lay people, I don't know, maybe there should be sort of a compromised standard by which they can live. And so it kind of changes.
One of the things that fascinates me was, I don't know how to pronounce his name, Volscian?
I don't know.
Anyways, it says that Augustine wanted the aristocrat Volscian to know that he could take the plunge without hesitating. He could become a Christian without changing his habits. Mm. You know, like just kind of affirm this creed, change some of your beliefs, and bada bing, bada boom, Yeah. You're now a Christian. And man, that resonates. I mean, thankfully we don't ever do that anymore, right?
Yeah, right. That's exactly what the problem in our setting is in many cases, right? Which is that Christianity has become an intellectual exercise. And if you can kind of, you know, get the theological quiz right, mark the right boxes, then we'll dunk you and you'll be initiated into the life of the church. And there you go.
Which again is scholasticism to us, you know, the Enlightenment, all that stuff. But I think there's nothing new under the sun. There's hints of Gnosticism with this.
Right.
That Christianity becomes this secret knowledge that saves our souls.
Yes.
And that's it.
Yeah. Rather than the whole habitus being reformed and our identity being reshaped, our personality being reshaped around Christ.
Yeah.
We just supplement what is going on in our life with some interesting theological knowledge.
I mean, it almost also beckons back to this new movement of kind of self-enlightenment or, you know, awakening and different stuff, you know. Self-improvement, but I think a lot, you know, what's the terms that people use? Self-fulfillment, self-awakening, like it's this whole sense of just using
Christianity. Self-actualization.
Self-actualization, there we go.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if there's a lot more to say about the Augustine chapter. Basically, he just sees it as a continuation of the trajectory from Constantine, which has shaped Christianity at this point in our world. And so there's a lot more questions than there are answers, to be honest, raised through this section here. It just feels like it leaves us with tension about, like, okay, so how do we not just try to reproduce the early church, which we cannot do because we live after Constantine, we live after Augustine, we live after the Enlightenment, we live after the end of Christendom. But yet, how do we listen to what the early church really had to say to us about what it meant to be Christian?
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that I appreciate the most about Kreider's book is, I mean, he ends with basically saying, I don't have the answers. I've showed you kind of the history of ideas, how things have progressed, how some things kind of got off the rails. But we can't go back. He says on the last page, 21st century Christians must live with this heritage. We just have to deal with it. We need to figure out a way to move forward. And it's not going to be, it's going to have to be a synthesis and Holy Spirit inspired creativity of how to be faithful in our context.
Yeah. Maybe that's a good word for us to sort of wrap this episode with. We're going to do one more conversation about this book and kind of do it as a general summary of, like, hey, what did we learn? What implications does this have to our setting right now? And what do we want to do at Eucharist Church about this? So we look forward to you joining us for that final conversation in this series.
See you next time.